Good morning. I'm Jennifer Bissa. I represent Charlotte Zolman. Ms. Zolman is here with me today. She's sitting in the back row. We're asking the court to reverse summary judgment entered by the trial court in this matter. This is a workers' compensation bad faith case. Mrs. Zolman was injured on the job. No dispute about that. Covered by Pinnacle Assurance. No dispute about that. She went through a brief course of medical care, was placed by the doctors at Maximum Medical Improvement, and she went through the process to contest that, the denial of any further medical care. And she also went forward on issue a permanent total disability, which she lost. This is an unusual case from the standpoint that it took more than a year to try the case. There were five hearing settings, and it finally resulted in the end with an order granting her ongoing maintenance medical care benefits. From the time that she was placed at Maximum Medical Improvement in August of 2005 and June 2007, there were no medical benefits provided, and her condition in that time period deteriorated. She had a compression fracture in the low back. She discovered she has osteoporosis, and as a result of that compression fracture, she developed a couple of conditions. One's called spondylolisthesis. That means that the L5 started tipping over, which causes compression on the nerves that go to the leg. That compression fracture also triggered that vertebrae to collapse in height, also causing additional problems called lateral recess stenosis and a herniated disc. Those conditions were not discovered by the physicians during the initial course of treatment, although Dr. Reese, the orthopedic surgeon who was authorized to treat her, did identify the spondylolisthesis as a problem.
I ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to get some context after reading your briefs to determine what it is and what time period you're contesting here. It's my understanding there was an injury, there was an award.
Right, and it's after the award.
And then it went to an ALJ hearing, and there were doctors who examined her, and then there's a post period after this ALJ hearing. Now, is your focus, are you recontesting what happened before the ALJ hearing, or are you contesting only what happened after the ALJ hearing?
After the ALJ hearing, after she got an order entitling her to benefits. I think the time period before that certainly put Pinnacle on notice that she had a need for additional medical care, and they did nothing to investigate it. So what I'd like to move to is the problems with the district court's dismissal of this case. First of all, he looked at it as a coverage case. It's not a coverage case. She was awarded the benefits. So the next thing is there a question of fair debatability here? First of all, he focuses on, well, she's at Maximum Medical Improvement for the compression fracture. So, you know, that's it. But that's not what happened here, and the medical evidence supports a conclusion that her condition deteriorated, she had chronic pain, she still has chronic pain, and she still has a need for medical care. She's no longer able to work, she's living on Social Security disability benefits of less than $600 a month, she's got Medicare, and on that budget, she's barely able to support herself, and she certainly can't afford medical care.
Now, what new evidence is there after the ALJ hearing that you're relying on?
Several things, Your Honor. One, there was a CAT scan that was done in June of 2007, which showed that she had...
By whom?
It's in the record. It was ordered by Dr. Primack, and the CAT scan was read by a radiologist, and there are a couple of them. There's Dr. Haluska, and there's a Dr. Anderson. They read the CAT scan as showing that there was a collapse in the vertebrae, and there was what they called severe facet changes. She went from mild facet changes to severe facet changes in a two-year period of time.
Okay, as Dr. Prime.
After the ALJ ordered Dr. Primack, he's not objective. He starts coming up with reasons for why it's no longer work-related, even though it's his conclusions about that. He changed his opinion, saying that it's just now a degenerative condition.
Isn't that consistent with his original opinion that what she was complaining about was not the result of the work injury? I mean, he never backed off of that, did he?
He did. We took his deposition during the course of the workers' compensation case in September of 2006, and that's part of the record in this case. He testified that he understood she had spondylolisthesis slippage, that she had mechanical instability in her back, and that could explain her pain complaints. He flip-flops all over the place. Oh, she doesn't have this problem. She doesn't have, you know, facet problems. She doesn't have a disc problem. She doesn't have radicular problem. Well, by 2 years later, she had all those problems, and he recognized that this injury set her up for instability in the low back. So she's got mechanical instability in the low back, which is triggering these ongoing pain complaints, and it's gotten worse. It hasn't gotten better.
That's part of my confusion. You're talking about a 2006 statement, and you told us earlier that we're talking post ALJ order, which I understood is around May 2007.
Correct. And I guess what I'm trying to get across here, Your Honor, is that Dr. Primack flip-flops in his opinions, and then it's not reasonable to rely on him to deny medical
care. Where
has
he flip-flopped after the ALJ order?
Well, he flip-flopped a number of times. He recommended epidural steroid injections before maximum medical improvement. Then he testified at hearing without seeing her again that that wouldn't help her. Then she goes back to him. He says now it's all a pre-existing problem. And after that, she went through treatment using Medicare and showed that she definitively had those problems, that she's got facet problems, that she's got a herniated disc.
That she's hearing got anything that's post ALJ, though, from what you're saying.
Well, he closed her case. She went back to him for medical care, for treatment, for chronic pain, and he closed her case. He closed it down. He refused to provide treatment, and the reasons that he did it, he made up.
Well, when you say he made them up.
He made them up.
I mean, where in the record is there support for that?
There are several things. There's the CAT scan that was obtained at that time that showed that there was a distinct deterioration in condition. There are the medical records from Dr. Yamamoto continuing to diagnose mechanical low back pain. There are records from Dr. Schwartman, an anesthesiologist, who performed injections with great benefit. There was a subsequent MRI which showed the deterioration. There's one more thing.
Sure.
One of her authorized treating physicians is Dr. Brian Reese. He saw her in July 2008 and concluded also she had the spondylolisthesis, the lateral recess stenosis, that it was work-related and that the treatment was either surgery or injections.
But did Dr. Primack, I mean, even in his later reports, didn't he acknowledge that she had all these things? He acknowledged that the injection may have helped her, but didn't he continue to conclude that none of these conditions that had been identified by the other doctors were related to the work injury? And wasn't that consistent with what he had said all along?
He didn't see her after all these other doctors provided care. He saw her in June 2007, shut down her medical care. She went through Medicare. She went to Dr. Yamamoto, Dr. Schwartman, and Dr. Reese, and Dr. Primack didn't see her again. When we deposed Dr. Primack and we submitted his transcript in our petition to reconsider, he actually said that he wasn't going to help her. He recognized she had chronic pain, and he wasn't going to help her until she quit smoking, and that's just brutal. That's a derogation of his responsibility. He knew when she came back in June of 2007 that she had chronic back pain. And he drop-kicked her out and said, you know, you're on your own. That's abandonment of a patient. He sent her to a primary care physician, and she chose Dr. Yamamoto. But this is about, you know, this is about insurance bad faith, and I don't have a lot of time here this morning. And so what I'm asking you to do is reverse summary judgment because the conflicting issues of fact regarding her medical care. We're asking you to take a look at the Savio case. The Savio case has established the standard in this state, and it applies here. But the standards that apply is that you don't get to deny medical care until you've investigated, evaluated new information, and made a decision on that. It comes directly from the Savio case. It comes also from the Colorado Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act. The Colorado courts, there are no decisions applying the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act to workers' compensation claims, and it should, and I'm asking you to do that here. Those standards are the ones that our expert expressed in his opinion and report in his affidavit. They were also admitted to by Amanda Cooper, the adjuster who handled the case. Those standards mean that you don't have a question of fair debatability unless you look at the new information investigate, evaluate, and resolve it. And here, the deposition testimony of Amanda Cooper illustrates the problem. She didn't look at it. She just denied it. She didn't reconsider the position. So Ms. Ullman has been left, you know, flapping in the breeze with no medical care, and that's not a good faith treatment of an injured worker. So we're asking you to reverse summary judgment. our position is that they can only deny it based on investigation. Pinnacle's position is they don't have to investigate or review new information. We're saying you can't rely on a biased physician, and we provided evidence of bias by Dr. Primack. One, in our motion to compel information about Dr. Primack, we submitted a testimony where he's charged Pinnacle upwards of $10,000 for IMEs, up to $10,000 a day for providing testimony in cases, so there's a financial connection there. We've discovered more information since then that implicates the bias of Dr. Primack. That motion to compel was pending for months before Judge Stern. He referred it to a special master. He didn't review it. He didn't review the testimony. And I don't even think he reviewed the order of the special master. It said, yes, the financial relationship between Pinnacle and Primack is relevant, admissible, and discoverable for the possibility of admissible evidence. And we submitted that with our motion for reconsideration. I only have 3.5 minutes left. I have a lot more to say, but I also want to reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Hey, good morning. I'm David DeMuro. I'm here with Mike Steiner. We represent the defendant, Appellee Pinnacle Assurance. Try to start off by trying to address some of the issues that Ms. Bissett raised and some of the questions that you had during her opening portion of her argument. Our position, of course, as you know from reading the briefs, is that there was no change, nothing different in the positions of the doctors that were relied upon post-ALJ decision that there was before the ALJ decision. It's very important, and Ms. Bissett talks a lot about the bias of one of these doctors, Dr. Primack. It's important to remember how these doctors were selected. They were not selected by my client, Pinnacle. Under the law at the time, if you were injured, your employer could choose a designated provider. This particular employer chose Concentra. Ms. Zolman went to Concentra, went to Dr. Danahay, who was more of a generalist. Dr. Danahay brought in Dr. Reese, the orthopedic surgeon, and Dr. Primack, the physiatrist. This is not someone Pinnacle hand-selected to control this case. Dr. Reese discharged her from care in May of 2005. The injury was in December of 2004. Dr. Primack and Dr. Danahay said she's at MMI in the fall of 2005. Plaintiff properly, as they have a right to do, contested that, said, I want to have a division IME. There was a dime doctor, Dr. Krieger, who looked at the matter, totally agreed with Dr. Primack, with one exception. He said her degree of impairment was slightly greater, but otherwise completely agreed with Dr. Primack and said she is at MMI. She does not need further treatment. And then at that point, plaintiff went out and found, and by testimony of plaintiff, found a physician named Dr. Yamamoto that plaintiff's counsel had chosen. And Dr. Yamamoto came up with a number of things that he felt should be done to Ms. Zolman, including epidural steroid injections. They then challenged that in the workers' comp system. As Ms. Bissett said, the hearing went on for a year, five hearings, and culminated in an ALJ decision that found Dr. Primack to be credible, rejected Dr. Yamamoto's positions, completely sided with the position of Pinnacle. Ms. Bissett says, well, she won the right to post-MMI treatment. Well, if you read the ALJ opinion closely, I think you'll see that Pinnacle stipulated to post-MMI medical benefits, but that's the way it is under Colorado law. Once a workers' compensation claimant is injured and reach MMI, they're not entitled to further medical care, except if they need additional medical care to maintain their condition. And Pinnacle stipulated at the time to something called Lidoderm patches, which was a little pain treatment.
Oh, excuse me, counsel. Over and above the patches, is it accurate that post the ALJ's order, if Ms. Zolman wanted to file an application in the workers' comp proceeding to get another hearing on whether she was entitled to any kind of treatment that she felt that Pinnacle had denied, or even to request a new lawyer, she could and I guess still could do that?
Yes, Your Honor, and actually, there's a couple things she could do. One is, and the ALJ order makes this clear, the case remains open for possibly for her to come back and say, I need further treatment for post-MMI treatment to maintain my MMI condition. She can come back and challenge that, and the order also makes clear Pinnacle has the right to contest that as to reasonableness, relatedness, necessity. So that's one option that's available to her any time. And as I heard the argument today, I almost felt like hearing the start of the argument, we were before a workers' comp ALJ rather than this court. I think her forum, if she feels she's not being treated properly today and has significant complaints, her forum is back before a workers' comp ALJ. So that's one way she could do it, is to go in and ask for the post-MMI benefits. The other way she can do it is go in and ask for, she can contend she's had a worsening of condition, which under the Workers' Comp Act, if you meet certain conditions, you can go back in and try to establish that.
Now, although, as I understand the Savio case, she's not limited to that. She could, she can file a bad faith claim as well, but I just wanted to understand whether she has that option or not to go into the back to the workers' comp proceeding.
Yeah, she does have that option. In fact, Your Honor, I just found out yesterday there's a case sitting pending before this court where the workers' compensation case, which is still open, has worked its way up to this court and is actually before this court. A notice of appeal was filed by Ms. Bissett in 2010, CA, I believe it's 2407, where she has raised, and the court can take judicial notice of its own files, she has raised as advisory issues on appeal such things as whether Dr. Yamamoto, whether it's proper for Dr. Yamamoto not to be have a change of physician to him, whether she should get this additional treatment, et cetera. The kind of things you heard discussed today about Ms. Zolman's condition are before this court on another case in the workers' comp.
That doesn't preclude this action.
It does not preclude this action, Your Honor. I agree with that. Savio is clear that the bad faith case can be ongoing and the bad faith can be maintained. But what I'm saying is that to the extent that she's seeking recovery on those items, she does have a forum. That's not that. But you make a good point. Let me go back to the bad faith case, because I think her argument leads me astray. The bad faith case, of course, is the standard is extraordinarily different from the comp case. In the bad faith case, I in rereading the briefs getting ready for this, it really illustrates the differences in opinion between counsel as to what the test is, I think. In the bad faith case, the test, we don't create a material question of fact in the bad faith case by having one doctor say one thing and another doctor say another thing. That would be, you have that before you all the time, and maybe an auto accident. One doctor says this injury is related to the accident. Another doctor says that's not. That wouldn't be a proper subject for summary judgment, and you'd reverse that one. It's different here. The test here, you have to go to bad faith law under Savio, which I agree is the controlling authority. And Savio says the test is, was the insurer unreasonable, and did it have knowledge, or was it reckless as to its unreasonableness? And then it goes on to tell us that in analyzing that reasonableness, you need to look to whether it took a position that was at least fairly debatable. It can even be mistaken as long as it took a good faith position. So my contention is I think hopefully it came through in the briefs that...
Let me ask you a question there. How do you decide that something is fairly debatable? Well, if I have a doctor and you have a doctor, is it fairly debatable? If I have three doctors and you have one, if I have four and you have two, where's the cutoff line?
I know what you mean. It's an interesting question. I mean, my position is that other states, I don't think this has been done in Colorado. There are a number of other states that would say if you have one doctor Then the insurer can rely on that in that position, assuming there's not, the doctor isn't being paid off, assuming some gross misrepresentation. If you have one physician, then that is sufficient to create fair debatability, and that settles that issue. That's the Lorette case from Nebraska, where, and I've asked this court, I think that that's where Colorado should go because it defines a specific standard. But here, Your Honor, what's extraordinary about this case and what the district court judge said when he said, what he meant when he said this case is devoid of evidence for plaintiff, what's extraordinary about this case is I've got all three treating physicians, I've got the dime physician, Dr. Krieger, and I've got an ALJ order. So all of that goes on from the time of the injury in 04 to the ALJ order in May of 07. And my client relies on all of that with nothing contrary except their handpicked physician and Dr. Yamamoto, who the ALJ rejects. And then what happens post, the question was asked, are we looking at pre-ALJ or post? When you get into the post-ALJ order time, what happens then? Right after the ALJ order, my client sends the Ms. Ullman back to Dr. Primack. Dr. Primack says she's got problems, but they're due to her condition, and she needs to exercise, stop smoking, that sort of thing. They're not work-related. The next month, July, Dr. Yamamoto comes out with a letter that says, here's all the things that need to be done. Well, that's virtually the identical letter of treatment that he recommended in January or February of 2006 that the ALJ specifically rejected and said, I'm not going to order any of that. It's either not work-related, not appropriate. So then we started,
let me ask you a question. On page 17 of the opening brief, in the middle, there is a statement that Dr. Yamamoto, Dr. Schwettman, Dr. Rees, and the radiologist identified rapid deterioration in the structures of Zolman's low back, resulting in mechanical instability, pain, dysfunction, and the need for ongoing medical care. Is that true or untrue?
Well, I would contest somewhat. I think it's somewhat an exaggeration of the position those physicians took. It is true that Dr. Schwettman, referred by Dr. Yamamoto, gave an epidural steroid injection, that there was testimony that provided some relief. And apparently Dr. Schwettman contends that that's a work-related condition. So let's accept that as true for purposes.
If it is true, then why isn't that fairly debatable? Why does that get us into fairly debatable? Why isn't that a question of fact?
And that gets us right back to your other question, Your Honor. I contend that creating having a conflict between the two physicians may preclude summary judgment in the workers' comp case, but not in this case. In the bad faith case, as long as the insurer takes a position that's reasonable, which means at least fairly debatable, then it's insulated from liability. And that means, as I read the cases, such as Brandon and Savio and the other Colorado cases, that means that if you have physicians to rely upon, if you have good faith reasons to rely upon, and here we had three physicians, the dime physician and the ALJ order, then that is a reasonable position to take, and as a matter of law, as the district court held, that means that the insurer is insulated from liability. Now, she may go back someday to the workers' comp. Maybe eventually her doctors will be right and the original doctors will be wrong, or perhaps she's had a worsening. All difficult questions, but not questions before us. The question before us is solely, did the insurer take a reasonable position? And based on this record, which is very substantial in favor of the insurer, that's our contention why it was a reasonable position. And it was
Mr. Camillo, can I ask you about the fairly debatable standard, because it's such a broad concept. Given what we know, that it's generally a question of fact, is it not?
It often is.
All right.
It often is, but Your Honor, I think you said in the bankruptcy of a state of Morris versus Kopik, I think you recognize and cited authority for the proposition it can be determined as a matter of law.
It can. There's no question about it. But
in the right case.
In the right case. And the question that we're trying to focus on here, I think, is post-award, post-ALJ, did things change such that what was originally reasonable and fairly debatable may no longer be fairly debatable? Or there may be a question of fact about it, because it's after the award that there appears to be changes in position or changes of view.
Well,
I agree that there's some consistency, clearly. But aren't there issues of fact relative to this?
Well, if there are issues of fact, the issues of fact go to disputes between doctors, which does not turn this case into an issue of fact for the purpose of the bad faith claim. It seems like it's so intuitive. We all know when issues of fact collide when there are doctors' opinions, it seems like that precludes summary judgment automatically. But you've got to judge it in the context of what we have here. What we have in the elements of the bad faith claim. What we have here post-ALJ is we've got in June of 07, Dr. Primack saying, it's not work-related. In July, Dr. Yamamoto comes up with the same arguments he's already come up with that have been rejected before. There's no reason for my client to reinvestigate that which has already been investigated and ruled on by the ALJ. Then you've got Dr. Schwetman said, well, I gave an epidural steroid injection. She's a little better. Well, all right, maybe that's something to consider. But then in September of 07, you've got Dr. Danahay, the original primary treating physician, he says, no, there's no change. She's at MMI. I'm discharging her from care. So, interesting questions. Maybe she has had some worsening and has a remedy elsewhere. But that doesn't create a factual dispute, a material factual dispute, in the limited context we look at for this case. And within that context, my client properly relied upon this long history of decisions by physicians and the ALJ order. I think I've hopefully responded to a few of those questions, and I'm out of time anyway, so thank you.
I'd like to help you with the fairly debatable questions. And if we go back to Savio and we take a look at what the Supreme Court actually, how they talked about that. In applying the test, whether there's unreasonable conduct and unreasonable denial of benefits, you have to look to see if the claim was properly investigated and whether the results of the investigation were subjected to reasonable evaluation and review, also consistent with the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. There are two cases I've cited in my brief, Hangartner versus Unum Provident, and also Reagan-Wilson versus 21st Century Insurance Company, both California cases, say the same thing, that whether something is fairly debatable, whether an insurance company can rely on it, depends on the investigation that they do. If there's no investigation, there's no fair debate. If you were to read Amanda Cooper's deposition, the adjuster responsible for this claim, she admitted to the standards and she admitted there was no further investigation post-award after all this additional information came in that demonstrated, one, the condition deteriorated, two, we know exactly what the diagnosis is, three, we now know what the treatment is, and Pinnacle chose to ignore that. Under those circumstances, they haven't established the threshold of fair debatability.
So let me ask you a question, though. If assuming all of that is true,
yes, sir,
the issue still was whether it was caused by the work-related accident, and if that has not changed, if that opinion never changed,
whose opinion?
The physicians on behalf of Pinnacle and the workers' comp case.
Dr. Reese's opinion changed.
Okay.
Is it? He's an authorized treating physician.
Did he say it was caused by the work?
He did, and that report is in the record.
Okay.
It's a one pager. It's very brief.
What's the date of that report?
July of 2008. So there's no basis after they get an ATP report saying, here's the problem. It has worsened. She has more slippage. She's now, those conditions with the slippage, the triggering of lateral recess stenosis, and that's identified by the radiologist. Those reports are in the record as well. So the judge just went off in the wrong direction. It's not a subjective standard. It's not based on whether there's a coverage question. This boils down to this woman worked hard to get an order for medical care. She got an award for medical care. They sent her to their preferred physicians, and Concentra probably does almost all their work for Pinnacle. We now know that they also have physician incentive bonuses for physicians to get these cases closed. That's even how Dr. Primack's business markets to Pinnacle. We can save you money on your costs. So the overall goal of closing the claim trumped Mrs. Zolman's need for medical care, and she still needs it. So we'll ask you to reverse the summary judgment. We'll ask you to implement the Colorado Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act as it should be applied to workers' compensation cases. That fair debatability is based on an objective, prompt investigation of new information, reconsideration of a decision. You can't just force someone through needless adversarial hoops to achieve benefits. They had sufficient information to approve this benefit and they refused. And that is not good faith. Show me where they treated this woman in good faith. They didn't. So I ask you to reverse summary judgment, give her an opportunity for her day in court.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments this morning. Case will stand submitted. We'll get you an opinion in due course.